It's Saturday, November 14th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 KUSP, Santa Cruz, and streaming live worldwide at KUSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Brian Young. He's a CG artist, iOS developer, and a lifelong tinkerer.
Hey, Lyle. How you doing?
Good. I'm doing really well. Thank you. And Miles Elam is also here with us, political junkie and software engineer. Hi, Miles.
Hi.
Brian, I recently saw a post of you or your wife of a refrigerator halfway through a window. Did you have to do that because of the shape of your home?
Yeah, we had to do that because of math. Math didn't work out. It seems our doorway is exactly 29 and a half inches wide, and the refrigerator, if you take the doors off, might be 29 and a half inches wide. So I went for the window route.
You have a big window.
Yeah. Well, especially when you take the whole frame out.
You took the frame of the window?
Okay, so I live in a simple cabin built right around the end of World War II.
A log cabin?
Well, sort of, yeah.
It's
faux log cabin.
Yeah, okay.
So all you have to do is take the trim around the front of the window off, and there's no shims, no nothing holding this entire box in that the nice modern aluminum window sits in. So it's real easy to do. It only took a morning.
So in other words, you took advantage of a window of opportunity.
Oh, no. You've been thinking that the whole evening.
So let's do a few quickie stories first. Let's go on in Moscow, Brian.
Okay, this is great. In honor of Star Wars coming up here pretty soon, the Star Wars 7, which I'm pretty excited about.
Do you have tickets?
No, I think Melanie might have gotten.
I asked last week too, and I already have tickets. You guys don't.
I know, but are you watching the trailers? I'm not.
Yeah. We covered this last week on the show. I'm sorry.
Are we doing duplicates? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in Odessa, this is in. Not Russia, this is the Ukraine. Yes. In Odessa, there was a sculpture of Vladimir Lenin.
As that happened, that happens all over the place.
Oh, yes, it does. In front of a big factory, a local plant. It's called, actually, I shouldn't say it. I'd butcher the name of it. Anyways, this thing had fallen into disrepair and they wanted to replace it. So what did they replace it with? They modified the sculpture and replaced Vladimir Lenin in the same pose with Darth Vader.
Yes.
Because putting up statues of Lenin and Stalin are actually now forbidden.
Right. Forbidden. In fact, you're supposed to take them down as they have time. Yeah.
So apparently Odessa is known for some cultural diversity and some flippant sense of humor. But I thought this was awesome because not only did he put Darth Vader up there, but they put a Wi-Fi hotspot right in the helmet so that everybody going out for lunch has plenty
Wi-Fi
of signal.
Wi-Fi supported Darth Vader sculpture in the Ukraine. Awesome. Thank you. Miles, can you beat that?
There's a practice going on by a particular Google engineer that I really wish would take off.
Okay.
Had to do with USB-C cables. USB-C being a new spec for USB, and as opposed to the rectangular ones you have now, which are kind of quantum in that they have a superposition. You try to plug them in one way. It's like, oh, flip it over. It doesn't work that way. Flip it back to the first
one. You know, the other way I've heard of this is that if you take a four-dimensional object and you cast a shadow in a three-dimensional in our world, mm-hmm. You can actually visualize a four-dimensional object because the shadow of that would be three-dimensional. And as you rotate it, it rotates many times. So you can rotate it and then rotate it again. And then if you rotate it twice more, it's not the same.
This is like the 1980s MTV logo.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, the three-sided logo that just kept
spinning.
Exactly.
So if you rotate one direction and you rotate it back, it's not necessarily the same shape. Just like a USB cable. You plug it in once, it doesn't work. You turn it over, it doesn't work. You turn it over again, it works.
But USB-C is meant to solve this. It is meant to be plugged in either way. It's also intended to be used as power.
Yes.
Which is useful for Google Chromebook Pixels and for Apple's MacBook.
Yeah, Apple's MacBook has one of these connectors on it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I've seen it. And the Pixel has it too.
Yes.
Okay. And are phones coming up with it as well? Is it going to be the new standard?
Some people have talked about that. I haven't seen them yet.
Okay. But seeing that Apple embraced is really exciting because it might be that soon they'll actually have one connector for all the devices.
I don't know. If you look at Apple's lineup, they're going both directions. Apple TV has it, but not the new phones.
Not all cables are made alike. I'm sure any of you who has purchased a cable for your phone, you know that some cables will wear out very quickly. Well, okay, if they're Apple cables, they wear out very quickly, no matter who you buy them from. But that's a whole other story. But with regard to USB-C, it becomes very important because it can allow power, like a fair amount of power.
And it's a thin cable.
In general, yes, it's quite thin. And so...
So ouch is what you're saying.
Benson Leung of Google has taken upon himself to go through Amazon, the different companies making these USB-C cables, especially the USB to C to A connector.
The standard USB connector to right. This small connector.
The bridge from the future to the past, as mm-hmm. it were, and has started to rate them. Has gone through extensive testing to say, like, hey, they're using the wrong resistor.
And oh, really?
According
like
to the spec, yeah. This is not going to work correctly. Okay. Don't buy this. Oh, hey, here's one that works correctly.
Is this a blog that he's posted or something?
No, these are Amazon reviews.
Oh, so he's
and
okay.
He actually identifies himself as, hi, Google engineer Benson Leung here again.
Oh,
and,
awesome.
I really wish that more engineers would do this. This would be awesome because it wouldn't just be the layman going, yeah, I plugged this cable in and it seemed to work for me.
And you don't necessarily know. Right. So you're saying that someone that you can trust because they work at Google and you think Google engineers are like intelligent or something?
Someone who has a degree in engineering and knows how to evaluate the innards to not just base it on luck.
Yeah.
This cable happened to work, but this is what's inside. This is what the spec says you're supposed to have. And therefore, this is out of spec.
Yeah.
So it's
and it would be less reliable.
So we've got a spec, but we don't have any sort of standards body that certifies things or anything like that. It's just assumed that if somebody says this is a USB cable, that it follows spec.
Well, bear in mind that a lot of the stuff is also made overseas, and it's that same country that won't be named that supplied animal food with toxic materials in it not too long ago. And so
I agree, though, there's not a certification of cables now. And if it was, it would be a industry-led thing. So you'd have to look on who's in the consortium of the industry, and therefore you'd have to just assume that they're boosting up their own cables. I don't think there is that.
Right, which is why Apple actually made the MFi spec for their cables for Lightning.
Oh, yeah, right.
Because that's a trademark, and if someone tries to sell it...
They have to manage that spec to get
yes.
To be able to
otherwise,
use the
Apple actually has a recourse to sue them.
So, yeah. So for years, I remember hearing about these USB charging plugs. What do you call them? The wall plugs that you put in the wall, that you put your USB cable in to charge your phone or whatever. And there was warnings about getting cheap ones of those because it would damage the power system on your phone or something like that. I haven't heard of problems lately.
I haven't heard of problems lately either. But they definitely the different qualities of them matter a lot.
And this is definitely going to be an issue as you have more laptops being powered by this because your cell phone transformer will not power your laptop.
Right, even though the connector will look the same. And I mean, even an iPad, a full-size iPad, won't work on a lighter quality USB port. You have to have more power in it. So this kind of thing already exists. So the ratings just are on Amazon, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Even if you're not an Amazon customer, even if you don't like Amazon, using the review system is really useful because you can get people's feedback, especially if
Are his reviews bubbling to the top? Are they the first ones that you'll see, or do you have to search for them?
Some of the cables don't have many other reviews.
Cool.
And in fact, the ones that he talks badly of, likely they won't get many more reviews, or at least hopefully that's the way it'll work.
Like USB in general has kind of transformed the way we plug things in, right? All keyboards are USB. Everything seems to be USB now, kind of replacing the universal like floppy drive kind of everything was floppy.
And getting
drive
fast before. Enough now that just a local network connection would be replaced with just a USB
sure.
cable now.
Sure. Brian, speaking of floppy drives.
Yeah, yeah, floppy drives. So this is a blast from the past. Can you believe that there is still a thriving, well, maybe thriving is overselling it, but a market for floppy disks out there? What was the last computer you actually touched that needed a floppy disk in some way or had that even as an option?
I have a Windows machine under my computer, which has a floppy, but I don't know if I've ever used it. I don't even use a computer anymore.
I mean, do CDs count as floppies?
No, not at all.
Why would you even ask such a thing?
Well, I mean, the idea of a floppy drive is just like this portable media of data. But yeah, it's not magnetic. Portable magnetic media.
So there's a article on digital trends, which I thought was really funny because it goes into how there is a company that has staked its entire business on keeping the floppy disk available. And this comes from the fact that during the 80s and early 90s, there was large machines, really expensive industry machines that were made on the latest technology, which happened to be the floppy disk. So these are the kind of machines that textile industry might use or something like that. They are really valuable, expensive things that you don't want to just simply replace, but the only way to transfer data to them happens to be a floppy disk. So he saw the need for keeping the floppy disk around and would buy up large quantities of disks as any particular manufacturer would start to go out of business.
Oh, as they stopped manufacturing, he'd get the last one so it'd be nice and cheap.
Right. So this article goes into how he bought a lot of 5-inch disks. Is it 5 1/4?
Yep.
Five and a quarter inch disks. And as it turns out, he has an overabundance of these still, but it's the 3 1/2. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is all by memory.
The hard floppy drives.
The ones that I remember.
The ones that aren't floppy.
I went into an Amiga store.
They are inside the case.
Yeah, but they're not outside the case.
I went into an Amiga store in the late 80s when I was trying to figure out if I wanted to buy one, and the salesman goes, yeah, these new discs are great. Watch. And he picked one up and threw it on the ground as hard as he could. You can't break it.
So are people buying these things?
Yes. People are buying them. People that use large embroidery machines, court reporters,
yeah, sure.
Even the Air Force nuclear silos. They prefer the 8-inch floppy disks.
Nice.
So actually, I think that's really great because I don't know too many viruses or worms still around that could infect a nuclear silo that might be on an 8-inch floppy.
That's
so
true.
And just before anyone calls in about it, yes, we know that it's nuclear.
Seriously? You still got to say that? All right. Awesome. Thank you. So now that we've talked about floppy drives still in use, let's talk about peanut butter. I have no segue for that. I'm sorry. Oh, good. Brian was drinking, almost lost it.
Yeah, for those of us who are not allergic to peanut butter, to peanuts, peanut butter is great. I give it to my daughter all the time. She loves it. I was unaware, however, that there was such a thing as caffeinated peanut butter.
Why would there be such a thing as caffeinated peanut butter? And I think that's not – I don't think that's a judgment against you as a person. I think it's okay. Wait.
It's
adding caffeine to peanut butter?
Yes, a company called Steam Peanut Butter.
It's the perfect food.
I believe the idea is that you would do it as part of your lunch and then you eat your afternoon cup of coffee. And then, you know, they add in electrolytes, you know, because that's what – caffeine-laced peanut butter eaters crave.
Do you like peanut butter that's been emulsified, that has emulsification stuff added to it? And is this one of those? Meaning, do you like the peanut butter that separates or doesn't separate?
I like the peanut butter that does not separate, that has the oil floating at the top.
You mean that does separate?
That does separate, sorry.
Okay. So the one that's called peanut butter?
Yes.
That one.
The one whose sole ingredients are peanuts, salt.
Sometimes salt, yeah. So, okay, have you guys ever had caffeinated water?
What?
Yes.
Why did you have caffeinated water when you were a programmer?
No, because I thought it was silly, but of course that's why I had to try it.
So when you and I were living in Los Angeles, I did a movie, and in the movie, the on set they had at the catering services and such, they had craft services, they had caffeinated water. And it was a late night film. We were taking over this this place. We were up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And so the craft service person decided to make a really strong pot of coffee with caffeinated water. And I drank a couple glasses of this. And have you ever OD'd on caffeine?
You had a few tremors.
It was really, really bad. And then I drove on the 405, which is not a good freeway to drive on, and started shaking. I was falling asleep and my body was shaking. So I pulled over and slept somewhere. But the point is that it's not a good idea to super inject yourself with caffeine.
Yes. And, in organic chemistry, in many colleges, you will synthesize caffeine.
That's right.
And had a friend of mine who was in her lab when someone dropped a beaker. And so the glass shattered on the table. And the person who dropped the beaker used their bare hand to get it off of the table to clean it up.
What form is it in when it's like
it's liquid? It's just a very high concentration of it. When you are synthesizing it, if you put a drop of it onto your tongue just as a straight stuff, that can be life-threatening.
So what they did?
But this was just through the skin, just the amount that would be absorbed through the skin. They had to be escorted back to their dorm room, shaking. They couldn't
to not sleep.
They could not be on their own recognizance. In transit.
All right. So caffeinated peanut butter. So you're giving it to your
daughter? Which is why New York Senator Charles Schumer is taking a look at this, asking, "What's up with this caffeinated peanut butter? Because this."
You know those little energy, 4 ounce or energy, 5 ounce, whatever those little bottles are that are everywhere? Is that just caffeine? Is that like the major ingredient? Sugar and caffeine?
It has something else in it, but yeah, it's...
I'll look it up.
But it's that term of like caffeine and electrolytes.
Yeah. All right, cool.
Because that's what active people crave.
So wait a second. So have you had the caffeinated water straight? Does caffeine have a flavor?
No, it has no flavor at all. The caffeine water is just like, it was just a bottled water that said... Crank H2O or Crank O2 or something. I can't remember. It was like And no, it just gave you a caffeine buzz. Do you do any caffeine, Miles?
You're like I don't, but I'm going to start soon.
Because you really like peanut butter.
Why?
It's just there's not enough hours in the day.
So you sleep a lot is what you're saying?
No, I don't sleep a lot. And that's why I'm kind of dragging and I need some pick me up.
All right.
My daughter's turning 4.
Ah, so you need to keep up with her.
So quickly, yes, it does have just caffeine and a few vitamins and things like that.
So basically the little, pick-me-up, 4-hour pick-me-up is basically a shot of caffeine.
Yeah, they say it's as much as a leading premium cup of coffee.
So instead, you could just get a bottle of or a jar of peanut butter.
Well,
and not, I mean, it'd be a lot
serving of the peanut butter is equivalent to 2 cups of coffee.
So
how
much is a serving?
Well, I mean, what you spread onto your bread.
2 tablespoons of peanut butter is like 6 grams of carbohydrates, right? So like that's like a serving is 2 tablespoons.
Okay.
So that much has – so it's like a tablespoon per cup of coffee. So I don't know. I guess if you really had to have a morning toast and peanut butter and coffee, you could kind of be shaking by the time you left the door. Are we done with this topic?
Yes, we're totally done.
Hey, so we had a couple listeners call in and email in with comments about, in general, the theme is trust. And specifically, we had Daniel about passwords. So what we're going to do is we're going to go into that in the next section. We're going to talk about passwords and knowing whether your system is safe and the general idea of trusting a system and how you deal with trust with regards to technology. This is Geek Speak. I'm with Brian and Miles, and my name is Lyle. We'll be right back. You're listening to Geek Speak on Independent Public Radio, KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me is Brian Young and Miles Elam. So we've covered peanut butter. That's good. We've covered floppies. Now let's talk a little bit about trust, and specifically – well, let's hear about Daniel's email to us a bit.
Okay, so Daniel wrote in. He's a user of the Dashlane Password Manager, but he's looking at these stories and he's wondering what good is a password manager when he's reading stories like these about KeePass, which is a different password manager, and a hack that's been going around to exfiltrate everybody's passwords that's using KeePass.
To export the passwords, basically.
To basically get all of the passwords and email addresses out of a person's machine who's using this particular password manager.
In that case, is that thing, what's the problem? Is it being saved in clear text or is it something more devious?
No. So a password manager encrypts all of the passwords.
A good password manager does. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Absolutely.
Okay.
But this particular hack, it's called the Key Farce. Every good hack has to have a good marketing name these days. Anyways, what it's doing is it's forcing the library that password manager uses to run the export function and dump the entire password database in the clear, in plain text, in a CSV file. And it's only possible because this hack, it can only be done when a person's machine is completely owned by the hacker. Somebody's gotten into the OS and taken over enough of the OS that they can run whatever they want.
Okay. So just let's back up for just a second. I'll slow this down a little bit. So a password manager in general, the idea behind it is you have a lot of passwords. For every single site, you have a unique username and password for the site. You put it in this one application. This application encrypts it with one password that you memorize and write down somewhere probably and maybe share with a friend so you don't lose it ever. And then that encrypted blob gets saved to the hard drive and maybe sometimes put on Dropbox and saved around. Without that password to unlock it, it's not really feasible to get access to that blob of data. And therefore, it's like a vault. It's like an encrypted vault, nice and protected. When you run the application, you have to type in your password. The machine then unencrypts that and makes it available. And it normally keeps that in memory because that's how software actually works. And then when you're going to your website, sometimes they have plugins and you can click on a button. And if you put your password in correctly, it'll insert the username and password for you in the browser, making it a lot easier to log in. Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've been recommending these things for years. That
we like LastPass. We like 1Password. There's also some open source ones. It looks like this person is using Dashlane. So I understand that if I run the application and I put the password in, I can get access to the password file because it's unencrypted at that point.
Well, it's unencrypted. No, it's not fully unencrypted. What it is the encryption key is in memory and it can decrypt from the database on the fly.
Ah, okay. So when I'm perusing through, it decrypts one part of it and shows it to me.
Yeah.
Or if I'm saying unlock, it will then decrypt it and store and put it in the fields of the browser for
me. Yeah. One of the important things that any software developer of a password manager has to do is make sure that they don't just decrypt all of this into memory to be used. Because there's different hacks to address different parts of memory and pull these things out. So there's lots of mitigations to keep parts of the memory secure and only decrypt what you need to. What happened in this case, though, is that the hackers were able to figure out a way to just tell the code, just export it all.
Okay, so that's a really important feature of a password manager is that you spent time working on this database and saving your passwords and all that, and maybe you want to change systems or something, or you want to change password managers. You want to get access to all your passwords because the only place that password really is in the system. So an export feature is essential. So you export it to a floppy drive. And you stick it in your drawer, right? So in case that your machine gets lost or broken or whatever, you can still get access to the files. And at that point, you don't necessarily want them encrypted because you don't necessarily want to run that software again. So the feature of exporting all of your passwords is a really important feature to these things to have.
Right.
In fact, if I didn't have one of those, I wouldn't use that software because at some point, I know I'm going to want to migrate away. And that's the only way to do it. Unless I manually go through and copy and paste them.
That's the point. You don't want to have to make work for yourself.
So Daniel's question really is, if it's so easy to do this kind of thing, why even bother? Is it really worth it? Is that kind of the gist of it?
Well, yeah, that's exactly it. He says, why would anybody go to the trouble of muscling through his passwords? And why would they do it? There's no money in it for them, at least. That's his
what's
question.
What's the goal? I see.
Yeah, why would anybody want Daniel's passwords?
Okay, well, let's back up for a second and just talk about why I don't feel that problem is actually a problem.
Okay.
So when you said that what happens is if the software is running on the computer and it has privileges, another way of saying this is, I mean, I'm talking about some vulnerability, some security vulnerability, and therefore the machine has been owned, is the way we say that in geeky terms, hacky terms. And that owned, it starts with a P, pwned.
History lesson later.
Yeah. When that occurs, it means that some application is running on your system and it has higher rights than maybe a normal application and can do things like access memory space. And so in that situation, when you have a computer that's owned like that, the entire machine is controlled by somebody else.
Right.
It's not really even your computer anymore. The operating system is intertwined with the hacker's stuff.
Right.
And therefore, your password can be logged just from keystrokes. The application running can log everything you type. And therefore, as soon as you typed in your password to unlock your password manager, the application could actually unlock it as well and run it themselves. So in some sense, having a machine that's been compromised like that, it doesn't matter what you have on there. It's owned.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, that absolutely makes sense. We talk about how to protect yourself from that all the time, about updates and security, things that you can do to keep your computer safe. But his deeper question is, what does it matter? Why does anybody want his keys, his password?
Access. Yeah.
Yeah. And And it's an important question. I think my dad asks me that all the time. Why does he need to worry about this? But the fact is, if you have on your phone, this is about a computer, but our phones now have a massive amount of information about us, mm-hmm. whether it's all of the people that we know, or whether it's financial information, or any of these other things. Hackers can start using that if they wanted to.
Let's also take the point of view of many people who are trying to get into your system are not governments or secret agents or even the mafia. They're teenagers. Now, I want you to get into your headspace the notion of the teenager that just wants to goof around, play a practical joke. Now imagine they don't understand the ramifications of going into your Amazon account and buying a whole bunch of things that you wouldn't want, even though it's being delivered to your house.
Because it's funny.
Right, because it's funny.
I don't think the teenagers are the biggest problem, actually.
Well, no, but when people start to ask me,
Why
should I care if my computer is made available? You can't think about this as why would someone like me try to get into a computer like mine?
Right.
It's people who are different from you that have different and ulterior motives for doing so.
I think it's even more devious than that. People write applications that go ahead and run that then take advantage of these vulnerabilities and run automatically on themselves. It's not like someone's going to go and attack Daniel's machine intentionally.
Right.
If they are, there's basically nothing you can do about it.
That's what I meant by a teenager, because that's who a lot of script kiddies are.
Right, but it's not even that. It's like there's a living, breathing beast on the internet that is software that's running and trying to get attacking you. It's not like, oh, well, if I lock my door, there's a social norm that people won't break in, and Johnny down the street's not going to break my door down. Unless I leave it open, maybe he'll look around when I'm not home.
Right, but the question—
It's not like that. It's an active threat all the time, like an immune system and like a biological system. It's much more
that. I get, but there are many people I've come across where their question isn't why would a particular person want to get into my account or get onto my computer. The question for them ends up being, why should I care if someone gets on my computer if there is nothing there to be found?
Oh, okay. That's an interesting question.
And that's why I was saying, even if you think this stuff is fairly innocuous.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I don't know that many people out there who are on a computer have it completely innocuous. You log on to your bank from your computer.
So the question happens, though, is what happens if I'm not using it for my banking? I'm, all these caveats where it's just email, it's just Facebook. Why should I care?
Would you want anybody posting on your Facebook? No, I think the key there is the organism idea. The anything connected to the network is a part of this huge organism.
That's right.
And if you let parts of that organism be taken over by viruses, then you're going to have that giant organism eating itself alive. And that's what we see all the time now.
Yeah,
we see hack after hack, and we see these routers and other devices that are just put on the internet and left, and nobody ever checks to update them. Nobody ever checks whether they've been owned in any way.
And they get infected and spread stuff.
Continuing the biology metaphor.
Sure, I think we're loving it.
Your computer becomes a cancerous cell and starts doing bad instead of just being neutral or helpful.
Right. And actually, that analogy of having your machine be cleaned up, it's about being socially responsible in some sense, because if you let it be a festering problem, it will cause other problems. So the question – but again, for an individual, does it matter that their machine has vulnerabilities on it and things are running? Well, yeah. Your machine is doing things like attacking other systems, but also it's sending out spam. If you don't like spam, that's a good thing to not have it do. It also can be involved in illegal activity, like doing blackmailing of a corporation through what's called a denial of service attack. And the reason why these are so effective and such a problem is because so many computers are being taken advantage of. At the same
time, computers of people who say, I don't have anything on my computer that's worth protecting.
That's right. So a denial of service attack, if somebody wanted to attack the GeekSpeak website, by the way, it's geekspeak.org if you want to see notes about the show and all that, they could just take 1,000 people's computers that had been taken over because they didn't have security embedded correctly. A vulnerability occurred, 1,000 computers all of a sudden start hitting the GeekSpeak server, and that attack would cause the server to expend more resources and possibly go offline because of 1,000 computers doing that all at once. And that can only take place because these machines are taken advantage of. So it's really important that you harden your machine. At the same time, if you've got a Windows machine, I don't know if you can.
Windows has gotten better. I don't know.
Windows,
if that's
I'm sorry, I meant XP. What's,
okay. If you have a Windows XP machine or Windows 98 machine, yeah, it's time to update.
Yeah, yeah. So, but should people be feel responsible and feel like they should update? And what do they do? I mean,
if you are responsible for a machine connected to the internet, you're responsible to make sure that thing gets regularly updated.
That's a strong statement, sir.
No, absolutely. The problem is,
if you're driving a car on the road and you're not taking care of changing the oil and making sure the brakes are in working order.
Yeah, but wait. That analogy says if you don't do this, you're going to kill people. That's not the same thing. Like having a machine that's infected on the internet, it's like, yeah, that's 10% of computers connected to the internet. Like, who cares? Compared to an unsafe car. It's a very different thing. But I agree that there's a social responsibility.
There is. The problem is there's more and more devices that are being put on the network. We're buying and putting them on the internet that we don't have control over, that we don't have a way to force an update, or we don't even know how to check to see whether it's needs an update or has a problem. We're trusting the manufacturer to do the processes needed to keep that thing up to date. And that's the second thing. Manufacturers really need to take responsibility for that.
You think it's manufacturers?
Well, ultimately, yeah. Personal computers, they've already been doing it. All the operating systems are offering automatic updates
now. I have
a
simple solution for everybody, but go on.
I was actually thinking manufacturers are taking responsibility for this. That's where all these automatic update prompts come from. That's where that push to say update to the newest version comes from. But it's really hard to get people to hit that button.
Yeah.
They're saying like, oh, well, I'll do this later, or I'm right in the middle of something, or I just don't like to answer that. Yeah. I'm just going to get rid of it.
I think that the automatic updates have actually also gotten better. I think people definitely had an experience for a while where it was painful. Every time an update happened, all of a sudden the printer went offline. It became painful. I think it's
getting
easier.
Well, then you had to do
easier.
A reboot every single time. Yeah,
absolutely.
For every little thing.
Windows 10, and I don't know if we've covered this or not, but Windows 10, when you take the free upgrade to Windows 10, your automatic updates get turned on for you and you can't turn them off. I like that idea. Personally, I don't run machines that auto-update on me. I normally manage it myself, but I only do that because I'm responsible enough to manage them for myself, right? So I think that in general, the default should be auto-updating all the time. A really simple solution, if you're not sure what to do with regard to a computer and you're not sure about security and all that, you could go ahead and get something like the Chromebook, which is an operating system which has minimal threat vectors. Is that a good way of analogy?
Except for everybody's head just started spinning.
Yeah.
Threat vectors?
It basically means it's a really good web browser that's pretty secure. The operating system is made by Google. It's relatively cheap. If you go find the cheapest laptop right now, they're probably a Chromebook. If you're doing video editing or audio editing, it's probably not the machine for you. But
right.
Other than that,
the security comes from the fact that there's basically nothing stored on your machine.
That's right.
It's all stored on Google servers, yep. Which is a good thing and a bad thing. It means that if anything happens to your laptop, no big deal. You buy a new one and all your data is still there.
Do you still have Google stock, Miles?
I don't.
Okay, good. So you can trust what Miles is saying. You guys aren't concerned about all our data belonging to Google?
I do have some concern there. It's one of those things where you say, okay, well, I have all the information on my computer. Oh, look, my computer broke. I've lost all my information.
Oh, no, I have I have Google.
Yeah, or like I do regular backups. Oh, my house burned down. Well, I've lost everything. A Chromebook is the exact opposite, where it's like something happened to my laptop. Oh, well, I guess I have to go pay $150 to get a new one that has all of my data ready to go. But Google goes through that data and indexes it to give you ads.
So when I worked at UCSC in the IT department, I supported a graduate program in art. We migrated from our local mail servers, run locally, everything managed ourselves, the whole university, to completely hosted by Google. So now all UCSC staff and faculty and students have Gmail accounts. And I thought, God, that's kind of creepy, and it's going to save the university a lot of money. And it's kind of awesome because all of a sudden the services just work really well. I mean, I was mixed around it.
We at GeekSpeak did the same thing.
Yes, we moved to...
We used to have our own mail. Mm-hmm. And then we had like an episode where we talked about how great Gray Listing was because it cut out all the spam.
Gray Listing's awesome.
But it was something we had to maintain.
And we don't anymore.
For
we
a while
Google.
It was okay. It was just a matter of like every 18 months or so, it's like, oh, we have to go to drive to San Jose and deal with the machine or update it or do whatever. And then we switch over to Google, and now it's like
so easy.
It just
we're
happens.
So placid. So then I work at Netflix now, right? And Netflix all of our internal business solution stuff, all of our email, all Google. All Google email services, calendaring, everything, all that. Convenient, easy, great. This year, this last two years ago, my students' elementary school all switched over to Google, right? So all the students in the San Juan Valley Elementary School system have a Gmail account, and all the faculty have it too. It's so convenient and easy.
And so, but that's comes a down lot to of people. It comes down to trust.
So that's the question I have for you, Miles, because you were working for Google as a Google engineer. You were on the inside. You had a lot of training about security and vulnerability training mm-hmm. with regards there. I remember at one point I had a thumb drive. We were trying to transfer the show, recording of a show over, and I stuck my thumb drive into your computer. You pulled it out immediately. You said, no, this is a Google machine. I can't put anything else inside this. So do you – now you're not there anymore. You can actually kind mm-hmm. of talk freely. Do you trust the corporation of Google to take care of all these people, including our children's emails?
I trust Google to aggressively vet the security of their applications, their web applications.
That's important.
So someone outside of Google trying to get into your data, there are very few companies that I would trust more than Google.
Okay.
And let's just remember, their entire business model is based on that trust.
Right.
Right. Getting access to, like, if some malicious person who worked for Google wanted to get access to your data, they actually have very good processes, and many large companies do as well. Facebook has much the same thing, that they will look for target information, like if someone's trying to look up the data for their ex-girlfriend or something like that, and they will be charged, they will be fired, they will be denied access to that. They are very protective of that.
So I mean, as an engineer, even though you're trusting everything, you trying to get access to data could cause your termination.
Right. You are only given access to data that you need to do your job, and then they're still watching to make sure that you are not abusing that trust within the company. At the same time, I think of incidents like the G+ with YouTube, like to get a YouTube account or to make comments on YouTube, you have to have a G+ account and that did demonstrate, and they did reverse that decision, but mm-hmm. it did demonstrate a willingness to do something that was advantageous to the company, even though it was obvious that users did not want it.
But they're a corporation, right? I mean, that's kind of their job.
Right, and that's that thing. They're yeah. still a corporation. They're still that. But as far as corporations go, as far as just handling that data, I do trust them on that regard.
All right. That's good to know. I'm glad because I trust you, and therefore – all right. We have another story.
Fool.
We have another story actually triggered by Dan, I believe, but about passwords.
Would you trust a 11-year-old girl to make you a secure password?
Maybe. Yeah. Does she understand the idea of secure passwords pretty well?
Well, yeah, I think she does. In fact, it's pretty funny. She's getting her formula from XKCD, which has a fantastic review of passwords.
So XKCD is an online webcomic. It's xkcd.org if you want to go read
.com.
Some. Really?
Yeah.
If you want to go read some comics. Okay, go on. So does that mean that she's doing the giant strung together dictionary words?
She is. In fact, she's making sure she gets the best source of randomness that she can find. She's using a six-sided die to roll.
Two of them.
Yeah, two six-sided die to roll her dice to choose from the dictionary which word she's going to be stringing together to make a nonsensical phrase that would be long enough and still memorable enough that you can use it as a password.
How much is she charging?
$2 a password.
So wait a second. You have to – she writes it down and what, mails it to you or something? That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I hope she makes a lot of money. In fact, I want to go buy one from her.
A lot of money. She sold six of them and she's making about $12 an hour should she work full time at this.
That's great. So she's got a whole blog up called dicewarepasswords.com, right? Talking about it?
Exactly.
Pretty awesome. All right. So – what's her pattern work? We'll just give people an idea of how this works. If you want a really good password, what you do is you grab like six random words from the dictionary and put them together. Nouns are great. And all you have to do is then think of the picture, like the monkey holding the piano or playing the piano in a park on a sunny day. And you just take all those words and then that's your password.
That is. Yeah. And as long as you have enough words, it works completely.
And of course, the company that you're putting the password into has to accept long passwords, which is not always the case, unfortunately. So you're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm with Brian Young and Miles Elam. And we're talked about security and passwords and such of that nature. And we'll go on to other stories, too, in just a minute. Please do stay with us here on KOSP. It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KOSP and KOSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell speaking with Brian Young and Miles Elam. Miles, tell us about HTTPS certificates, please, sir. I figure we might as well get really geeky now.
Well, whenever you see the padlock, when you go to a secure site, that's sure. using HTTPS, and that is using a certificate. Certificate not just encrypting the communications, but also providing authentication to say, yes, that is indeed www.geekspeak.org mm-hmm. that I'm connecting to.
So in general, you find a trusted company, and they are called a certificate authority, mm-hmm. and your browser already has built in a whole bunch of these that it's trusted. And the way that your browser is trusted is that it has a public key from these trusted certificate authorities, a lot of them. Then I buy geekspeak.org certificate, and what I do is I make a certificate for my website, and I give my public key to one of these certificate authorities. They sign my certificate with their private key, and then every time you go to geekspeak.org, I pass out my publicly signed by someone you trust. You, as the consumer of this, get my public key that's been signed, go and see if it's authenticated by the CA that you trust, the certificate authority you trust. Mm-hmm. If it has been signed correctly, then you know that I am trustworthy because you trust them. It's all about a circle of trust.
So, okay. So
should we do it again?
I just saw all these people just glaze over. I hope nobody
okay,
had an
so,
accident.
So here we go.
Let's have Brian
you're going,
be,
hold on. You're yeah. going to the...
Wait, let's let
the
Brian do it.
I just want to point out for all of those people that completely glazed over at that point, all you need to understand is you are trusting this certificate authority. And as long as you trust that certificate authority to be accurate, the math works out. There is no way to break this encryption as long as that certificate authority holds their secrets tight
yes.
and that the website that has that certificate keeps its private certificate tight. Those two points of trust mean that that's completely a secure way of talking. Nobody can get into that as long as those two points aren't compromised.
And my analogy earlier about saying, I'm glad that you trust Google, Miles, because I trust you, is the same concept, right?
I was actually thinking, you go to a grocery store, you want to buy some booze. So
not
they
a grocery
say,
store.
It's yes.
too expensive.
Whatever. Anyway, okay, you go to a liquor store, you want to buy some booze.
And now you're talking, buddy. Now you're talking.
And they say, wait, are you eligible to buy alcohol? And so I pull out, this hasn't happened lately, but still, I like to dream. I pull out my wallet and I pull out my driver's license and say, here is the state of California through the DMV stating that I am who I am and that I am of this age that is legal for
so
alcohol.
So the authority is California.
California through the DMV. But state of California does not necessarily know about that specific transaction. In other words,
right.
you going to the site.
They don't know
that
you're always buying the booze. Yeah.
But the two of us can agree that this is an intermediary that is can certify that I am who I am and that I am eligible to transfer
that.
This
All
content.
Right. Cool. I think we nailed that. We've killed that horse. We've totally covered this topic.
Yes.
We understand certificate authorities.
But
why are we talking about it?
It requires that we trust the state of California in
yeah.
this analogy. It requires that we trust the certificate authority. So what happens if a certificate authority starts signing things they're not supposed to?
Well, then you stop trusting them.
Well, sometimes they're really big.
Oh.
And it's really hard to stop because if you stop trusting them, suddenly, for example, if you stop trusting Symantec, who owns VeriSign and Thought, you can't get access to 50%
of the internet.
Sites out there
okay.
that are running secure sites.
Okay, so because the system works such that you're not saying, hey, VeriSign, should I go buy booze from the liquor store? Instead, you're saying, hey, liquor store, I've been signed by VeriSign, so everything
mm-hmm.
we know is cool. If the liquor store is like, well, but except for VeriSign, I just had a 12-year-old come in here a second ago, and he had a sign from VeriSign, so that kid is definitely not legal to buy booze. Why should I trust you now? And all of a sudden, you can't
trust
anybody.
Was it a fake
anybody.
ID? If it was a fake ID, then you go like, oh, there's a vulnerability. We need to make
right.
the driver's
Wasn't
licenses
that.
Better, which we've done over
right.
time. That's
sure.
why driver's licenses have become have
holograms.
Holograms.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. But if it turns out that the state of California actually did issue that driver's license, the CA did issue that certificate.
If the processes got so bad that it was easy for that to happen, you got a really serious problem.
Right. In this case, what they did was they gave out certificates, or some various CAs, not just a single one, but various, gave out certificates for a reserved IP address 192.168.1.1, which many
hey, that's mine.
Yeah, may know from your home router. And these are ones that you never want to have a public CA give a certificate for.
It doesn't make any sense. It's like getting a certificate for a red door. It's like, well, there's lots of red doors in the world. That doesn't
right,
make any
exactly.
sense.
If you say, I want to get a certificate for geekspeak.org.
No, let's do the booze. Let's do the booze analogy. You get a driver's license. Instead of having a picture of you, it says brown hair, you know, Frank. Yeah. And you're like, or, well, this could be anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or it could be just like, this is a common mask. Like, let's say the anonymous mask, the Guy Fawkes mask.
Right.
Like, anyone who has a Guy Fawkes mask, you can get alcohol.
No.
Wait, no. You're not supposed to give. Wait. What is this driver's license?
Why
says Guy Fawkes.
Why did they do that?
Because their processes for doing, for
checking.
Handling that were not, internally in the CA's sure. own company, were not sufficiently
Well, so they also made an error recently by issuing certificates in other forms as well. They've had a whole bunch of test certificates that get out in the wild. I mean, they've been
yes.
VeriSign / Semantic / Thought, the same company, mm-hmm. has really messed up recently. And Google basically said, you've messed up so much that next year, every certificate you issue to anyone, you have to tell us about it first or we will remove you from our system.
Right.
Pretty serious problem.
If anyone... I believe, in my own personal opinion, if anyone but Semantic / VeriSign / Thought had done this, they would have been
wiped out.
Yeah,
right.
Immediately.
But they have 50% certificates.
Right, exactly.
In fact, not too many months ago, Google did the same thing to an overseas certificate authority.
Yeah, they took a system
yeah,
offline.
Yeah, they have an early warning system in Chrome that Chrome detected that they were using a certificate that they couldn't possibly have the rights to, and then they quickly shut that entire authority down.
Yeah, right. That's right.
And they've had instances where an Iranian CA did the same thing because they were trying to get access to Gmail and get that type of thing. But that's where this problem comes in, is who do you trust? Because the entire internet with regard to security is based upon trust.
Right.
And once that trust gets eroded, suddenly there's...
So to be really clear, the other reason why it's not just about whether you can buy booze, right? It's the issue has to be that if you're trying to go to a website like your Wells Fargo Bank site mm-hmm. and your browser is trying to negotiate whether it's trustworthy or not, you go to wellsfargo.com, and when you go there, the browser responds back with a certificate that says, yep, I'm Wells Fargo. Let's initiate.
Or the server comes back.
The server does,
yeah.
Sorry. And then your browser looks at it and says, is it signed by somebody I trust? If VeriSign or one of these companies that you trust automatically is doing it wrong, Miles Elam might be able to get a Wells Fargo certificate for his website. And then you could put up a fake site and say, I'm Wells Fargo, and your browser wouldn't know the difference, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the real problem. Someone devious like, well, actually, you're not very devious. But
And then another aspect to this is that certificates are based upon SHA-1. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead.
Oh, yeah, let's do the SHA-1 one. Come on, let's bring it on.
SHA-1, a simple hash algorithm, is a simple way to generate a 160-bit value that says this is a unique ID. This is signing the certificate to say if you take all the information that's in the certificate, you run it through this algorithm, you're going to get this ID back.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes the private key of the certificate issuer. So it's comes from also data that you don't have access to.
It's the math details of that whole thing we've been talking about. The actual details of this sometimes can be done in this way with SHA.
Right. And we knew that SHA was getting a little long in the tooth. It's been around for a while, and basically the decision whether it's worth it to stop using it and go on to something else comes down to cost. How much does it cost in terms of hardware and processing resources to generate what's called a collision, in other words, the same hash from different data, to forge that certificate?
Mm-hmm.
And a little while ago, it was like, well, it looks like it would happen in 2018. It would cost about $178,000 for a single instance. So that seems...
Meaning that if you spend enough hardware on this, you could actually break SHA-1 and you could therefore break the entire communication chain if you put $100,000 on
hardware. For a particular certificate.
And by breaking, you just mean you could be an imposter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or read the information. See the stuff that you're not supposed
to. That's what imposter is, right? Yeah. And the thing about secure a SHA-1 is it stands for secure hashing algorithm. 1.0, right? It was an early attempt, and it was secure the processing power.
There were several possibilities for it, and that was the one that was certified as saying. So it's not necessarily a 1.0 software like you would normally.
So what are we doing about it?
Well, it turns out that that estimate of 2018, $173,000, was a little optimistic. Now they're looking at something like $75,000 in 2017. In other words, the ability to hack it has gotten is faster than we expected.
And so do either of you know why it got so much faster, so much quicker?
There was the...
Oh, I know why. So if you don't know why, forget it.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Go for
it. It's Bitcoin. So Bitcoin required a better... I mean, Bitcoin made a surge in hardware-level hashing. And that created a whole bunch of these hardware-level systems that you could pre-program at a hardware level.
Yeah, I thought it was like the incorporation of GPUs for processing and...
Yeah, that as well. Doing,
but it made a financial incentive to make better hardware.
And so people made better hardware faster, and so the assessment and the price reduced, and there you go.
And so now Mozilla has already announced that they were going to any new certificates that use SHA-1 after January 1st of next year, they're going to flag as saying this is
not safe.
This is not safe.
That's a good idea.
And any certificates at all, like say you have a certificate that lasts for 3 years, after 2017, if you're still using it and haven't gotten a replacement, it will also get a message that flags it. Microsoft is now doing the same thing. Google is doing the same thing for Chrome. So this is once again that we can't trust it anymore, so we need to move to something that we can trust.
Right.
And unfortunately, you have so many people out there, it becomes that whole question of, but this is a driver's license. Yes, but that driver's license is from a few years ago, and California has switched over to the new driver's license with the hologram. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know it still says that date, but that's an old – those are no longer accepted anymore.
So wait a second. We're not in the business of scaring people here. What does this mean for the layman out there? Can they not trust going to Wells Fargo? Can they not trust going to a website anymore?
It means we're doing a good job, right? So Symantec had a problem, and they're getting slammed a bit, and it's going to be hard for them, and they're going to fix the problem. The system's kind of preparing and working for itself. Also, to take advantage of these things in a really negative way, you got to get really lucky or really take advantage of one of these systems. So them failing is more about making sure their process gets better, and they'll have to because it's financially incentive for them. And nothing right now is dangerous for you in any way of any of these stories.
And it's also to tell people that security is not it's either secure or it's insecure.
Right. It's a moving
target.
There really is a trust
level that comes in there, a probability that you're going to be. And if you go online to purchase something, it's probably almost certainly safer than if you called someone up on the phone and gave your credit card number over the phone.
That's true.
Like by orders of magnitude, I would actually.
Unless you're running a really old operating system. All right. Good. Cool. Let's talk about something else, shall we? Brian, can I give it up to you, the floor, anything you want?
Absolutely. So Jim Warner from...
my friend Jim Warner?
Yeah.
Supporter of the show and the station.
UCSC. Mm-hmm. He sent in a little interesting thing about a technology that is brewing in the future. This is nothing that is available right now, but it creates a really interesting story and something to keep an eye on. So
kind of connects with your whole Wi-Fi calling in some ways.
Yes.
But not exactly.
So... LTE-U.
The new... what is LTE stands for?
Don't even try that one.
I remember what it is. It's
okay, so we many of the phones, most of the phones being sold now, if not all of them, are being sold using the LTE band. But the wireless companies are always looking for more spectrum, more radio waves that will be more helpful to getting good signal to all of their subscribers. So in that effort, they are looking at a technology that would use the unlicensed bands of radio spectrum that a lot of our home electronic radio using devices use, including Wi-Fi.
Wait. So... the LTE, by the way, stands for long-term evolution, which means it's always going to upgrade and change and get
better.
And it's
going to evolve.
Right. And one of the things they're evolving is they want to spread the spectrum area that they're using to not just be the licensed area, but the unlicensed area,
right,
which is the same as what we get to use for Wi-Fi. It's why you don't have to get an FCC license to run your Wi-Fi router at home.
Right.
Because it's unlicensed spectrum.
So historically, you can't just take one phone to another carrier because they all have their own bands they're allowed to operate in because they got the license for it.
Mm-hmm.
If LTE-U became in use, then they could use all these bands that are available to everyone already.
And could potentially conflict with your Wi-Fi?
Well, here's the interesting thing. So there's a couple different standards of LTE that could use this technology, that could use these bands. There's one being developed in Europe that is supposed to be international, worldwide, and it's trying to, trying to conform to all the different laws around the world. So it's definitely going to be usable in the United States as well. But there's another standard that's being developed by corporations here in the U.S. that it's more focused on the U.S. market. And because of that, we have less regulation here, which has been a real boon for our technology. There's been a lot of leaps in technology because there's been less regulation hurdles to get over, and the FCC has had a pretty light hand compared to other governments around the world. But we're in a situation here where LTE-U is being developed in a way that let me back up and explain one thing about LTE and one thing about Wi-Fi protocols. So with Wi-Fi, Wi-Fi is considered a really nice citizen. Before a Wi-Fi router broadcasts on a particular radio frequency, it listens first. It goes, anybody else talking on this frequency? And if there's no, then it goes, okay, great. It can send its signal. LTE-U or LTE in general just broadcasts on that spectrum. So if you were to take a technology that isn't a nice citizen, that doesn't listen first, and put it on a band where one listens first mm-hmm. and won't broadcast.
One of them wins and one of them loses.
Exactly. All of a sudden, if that technology is distributed widely, our Wi-Fi is not going to work most of the time. We're going to have all sorts of hiccups, especially for real-time video and things like that.
Is the European one a little safer?
It is. It definitely is a good citizen that way. Now, this is nothing we're in danger of right now, but it's something to take a look at. Take a look at the video that we're going to link to and educate yourself on it. And if we have an opportunity in the future to talk to our representatives, we definitely want to put some pressure on these companies to make sure that their technology cooperates well.
Yeah, definitely. Wouldn't want a cell phone carrier to mess up my Wi-Fi. Hey, you're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me was Brian Young and Miles Elam. And Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you'd like it. You can even make money off it. Just let them know the geek said hi. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. And of course, in Santa Cruz, we're 88.9 on the FM dial. That's right. We're registered, and we don't mess up with your Wi-Fi. To find out more information about this show or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit us online at geekspeak.org, or, of course, you can email us, geeks@geekspeak.org. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, and thanks to Greg Merkley and Chandler for working on us remotely and making us sound so great on air. For GeekSpeak and for KOSP, I'm Lyle Troxell. Thank you so much for listening. And Brian and Miles, thank you also for being here on the November 14th episode of GeekSpeak.